Escuelas oficiales de idiomas de la región de Murcia. Pruebas específicas de certificación. Comprensión de textos orales. Nivel B2. Convocatoria, septiembre 2020.
Task 1.
You're listening to KRCU. I'm Dan Woods, and we're going public today with Angela Pierce. She's a naturalist with the Missouri Department of Conservation. Welcome to the studios.
Thank you.
We're going to talk about bears today, and I understand that there's been more reports of bears, at least an increase in reporting. So the first question is, why do we think that's happening?
Well, the increase in sightings is probably due to the increase in bears in Missouri. We are seeing an increase in our bear population. However, at what rate? And the exact numbers of bears in Missouri is still yet to be determined. We're currently undergoing research that started back in 2010, studying our bear populations, trying to figure out what exactly the rate of growth is and survival rate and all of that. So it's a pretty lengthy study for us to get a better idea of how many bears do we have, where are these bears going, what are they doing. There's a lot that we still need to learn about Missouri bears.
So with the increase and more sightings, there's more of a chance perhaps for humans to run into a bear and contact with them. So what should we do and not do if we see a bear?
Sure. So it's important to remember that black bears in Missouri are still considered to be an uncommon mammal, unlike, you know, squirrels or raccoons that you might see in your backyard.
Okay.
However, we are tending to see bears concentrate in more heavily wooded areas, especially in our Ozark region where the Mark Twain National Forest is. So if you're out camping in those areas or hiking, it is very important to be bear aware. So if you're out hiking, make sure that your presence is known to the wildlife and bears around you by talking, singing, making noise. Most likely that bear is going to smell you before they see you. They're going to hear you, and they're going to take off, because our black bears of Missouri, we're lucky they have not quite associated humans with food. So they tend to stay wild. They want to be elusive and not be around people. It's also important to remember that these sightings are very few and far between. It's not very common for a Missouri hiker to see a bear. And like I said before, more than likely, the bear's going to be aware of you before you are of it, and it's going to leave. If you do find that you've seen a bear in your area, It could perhaps be a young male who's been pushed out of the optimal habitat in those heavily wooded areas, and you see a bear in a more urban area. It's important to report your sighting to the Missouri Department of Conservation, and you can do that online or by calling your regional office. And if you do see a bear in town, it's important also to remember to not let that bear associate you with food. So any pet foods, you want to make sure you don't keep those out. Make sure your pet's finishing their meal and remove all bowls when they're done. Barbecue grills, go ahead and make sure those are clean and put away at the end of your grilling session. And garbage, make sure that's secured in a bear-proof area so that they're not finding food sources around humans. We don't want them to associate food with humans. And we like to say a fed bear is a dead bear simply because if a bear is...
You're listening to KRCU. I'm Dan Woods, and we're going public today with Angela Pierce. She's a naturalist with the Missouri Department of Conservation. Welcome to the studios.
Thank you.
We're going to talk about bears today, and I understand that there's been more reports of bears, at least an increase in reporting. So the first question is, why do we think that's happening?
Well, the increase in sightings is probably due to the increase in bears in Missouri. We are seeing an increase in our bear population. However, at what rate? And the exact numbers of bears in Missouri is still yet to be determined. We're currently undergoing research that started back in 2010, studying our bear populations, trying to figure out what exactly the rate of growth is and survival rate and all of that. So it's a pretty lengthy study for us to get a better idea of how many bears do we have, where are these bears going, what are they doing. There's a lot that we still need to learn about Missouri bears.
So with the increase and more sightings, there's more of a chance perhaps for humans to run into a bear and contact with them. So what should we do and not do if we see a bear?
Sure. So it's important to remember that black bears in Missouri are still considered to be an uncommon mammal, unlike, you know, squirrels or raccoons that you might see in your backyard.
Okay.
However, we are tending to see bears concentrate in more heavily wooded areas, especially in our Ozark region where the Mark Twain National Forest is. So if you're out camping in those areas or hiking, it is very important to be bear aware. So if you're out hiking, make sure that your presence is known to the wildlife and bears around you by talking, singing, making noise. Most likely that bear is going to smell you before they see you. They're going to hear you and they're going to take off because our black bears of Missouri were lucky. They have not quite associated humans with food. So they tend to stay wild. They want to be elusive and not be around people. It's also important to remember that these sightings are very few and far between. It's not very common for a Missouri hiker to see a bear. And like I said before, more than likely the bear's going to be aware of you before you are of it and it's going to leave. If you do find that you've seen a bear in your area, it could perhaps be a young male who's been pushed out of the optimal habitat in those heavily wooded areas. And you see a bear in a more urban area. It's important to report your sighting to the Missouri Department of Conservation. And you can do that online or by calling your regional office. And if you do see a bear in town, it's important also to remember to not let that bear associate you with food. So any pet foods, you want to make sure you don't keep those out. Make sure your pet's finishing their meal and remove all bowls when they're done. Barbecue grills, go ahead and make sure those are clean and put away at the end of your grilling session. And garbage, make sure that's secured in a bear-proof area so that they're not finding food sources around humans. We don't want them to associate food with humans. And we like to say a fed bear is a dead bear simply because if a bear is...
Task 2.
A building is just a building until it becomes part of a story, and the story becomes part of a legend. That's what happened to Rosalind Chapel, located just 7 miles southeast of Edinburgh, Scotland. The chapel was founded in 1446 by Sir William Sinclair as a Roman Catholic collegiate church, meaning it was self-governing, with financial support coming from the Sinclair family. What really made Rosalind Chapel famous was the 2003 publication of Dan Brown's best-selling mystery novel, The Da Vinci Code. This was followed by the huge box office success of the movie version in 2006 starring Tom Hanks. Rosalind Chapel now welcomes about 140,000 visitors each year. It's an easy, inexpensive public bus ride from the heart of Edinburgh. The number 22 bus takes you to the village of Rosalind just a short walk from the chapel. Indoor photography is not permitted, but published images and outdoor photography give you an idea of the intricate masonry and carving that first made it famous. The chapel we see today took about 40 years to complete, but it's less than half the size that was planned by Sir William. He died in 1484, and his heirs apparently decided it was big enough. A little over 100 years after the chapel was completed, the Protestant Reformation swept over Scotland. The Sinclairs were warned to close the chapel or risk losing their land and possibly their lives. They complied. The chapel sat abandoned and neglected for almost 150 years. At one point during the English Civil War, Oliver Cromwell stabled horses in the chapel. In 1660, the old Rosalind Inn opened next door. It attracted artists, writers, aristocrats, and royals. The great Scottish writer Sir Walter Scott campaigned to restore the chapel as part of an effort to build national pride and identity. The first major renovation began in 1837. The legend that attracted Dan Brown was the possible link between the chapel and a religious order of warrior knights called the Knights Templar. They provided protection to pilgrims who flocked to the Holy Land after the Crusades. In the process, they became very rich and very powerful. They built a fort on top of the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. When the Crusaders were driven out of the Holy Land, they returned to Europe. French King Philip convinced the Pope to disband the Templars. Eventually, there were mass arrests and executions, but some got away and may have been able to take some of the Templar treasure and holy relics collected in Jerusalem, most notably the Holy Grail, the cup Jesus used at the Last Supper, with them. Many believe the Templars became Masons and created the Order of Freemasonry, and that the Masons who built Rosalind Chapel did so with the idea of making it a sacred place to house the Grail and other sacred objects. Is that real history or just a good story? Whatever people believe, it's bringing them back to Rosalind. A building is just a building until it becomes part of a story, and the story becomes part of a legend. That's what happened to Rosalind Chapel, located just 7 miles southeast of Edinburgh, Scotland. The chapel was founded in 1446 by Sir William Sinclair as a Roman Catholic collegiate church, meaning it was self-governing, with financial support coming from the Sinclair family. What really made Rosalind Chapel famous was the 2003 publication of Dan Brown's best-selling mystery novel, The Da Vinci Code. This was followed by the huge box office success of the movie version in 2006, starring Tom Hanks. Rosalind Chapel now welcomes about 140,000 visitors each year. It's an easy, inexpensive public bus ride from the heart of Edinburgh. The number 22 bus takes you to the village of Rosalind, just a short walk from the chapel. Indoor photography is not permitted, but published images and outdoor photography give you an idea of the intricate masonry and carving that first made it famous. The chapel we see today took about 40 years to complete, but it's less than half the size that was planned by Sir William. He died in 1484, and his heirs apparently decided it was big enough. A little over 100 years after the chapel was completed, the Protestant Reformation swept over Scotland. The Sinclairs were warned to close the chapel or risk losing their land and possibly their lives. They complied. The chapel sat abandoned and neglected for almost 150 years. At one point during the English Civil War, Oliver Cromwell stabled horses in the chapel. In 1660, the old Rosalind Inn opened next door. It attracted artists, writers, aristocrats, and royals. The great Scottish writer Sir Walter Scott campaigned to restore the chapel as part of an effort to build national pride and identity. The first major renovation began in 1837. The legend that attracted Dan Brown was the possible link between the chapel and a religious order of warrior knights called the Knights Templar. They provided protection to pilgrims who flocked to the Holy Land after the Crusades. In the process, they became very rich and very powerful. They built a fort on top of the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. When the Crusaders were driven out of the Holy Land, they returned to Europe. French King Philip convinced the Pope to disband the Templars. Eventually, there were mass arrests and executions, but some got away and may have been able to take some of the Templar treasure and holy relics collected in Jerusalem, most notably the Holy Grail, the cup Jesus used at the Last Supper, with them. Many believe the Templars became Masons and created the Order of Freemasonry, and that the Masons who built Rosalind Chapel did so with the idea of making it a sacred place to house the Grail and other sacred objects. Is that real history or just a good story? Whatever people believe, it's bringing them back to Rosalind.
Task 3.
Located at 200 Baker Street, right by one of the entrances to the Tube Station, is TfL's Lost Property Office. It's been here since 1933, and currently receives over 1,500 items every day that are lost on TfL services, including the Tube, Overground, buses, and taxis.
Right, so this is the heart of the Lost Property Office, and every day we're getting 30 or 40 completely full sacks of lost property. It's just relentless, never ending. So every day we're getting well over 1,200 items of property coming through, and it's every single day.
In the 1950s, the most common item lost were pairs of gloves. But over time, things have moved on a little. You might think mobile phones would be the most popular loss, but actually, it's only second on the list. Items are sorted and catalogued onto a database, someone with a smart sense of humour called the system Sherlock. And in instances where the owner can be identified from the property straight away, contact is made to let them know. Government legislation dating back to the 1930s states that lost property must be stored for a period of time, in this case, 3 months. Now, you might not think that people are so honest, maybe even less so in London, but actually a quarter of items found on the transport network are successfully returned to their owner.
Sometimes the reaction we get when people come in and pick up their property is just disbelief. Firstly, a lot of people don't actually inquire about their lost property because they simply think, look, I've lost something valuable. It's never going to be handed in. And I think you'll find that the travelling public, Londoners in particular, are much more honest than you'd think they are.
Even more surprisingly, for items with a higher value, such as wallets, purses and phones, the rate is as high as 40%.
So every day we're getting over 150 mobile phones. It's really interesting. Whenever there's a new model is released, it takes probably no more than about 48 hours before we get our first phone in.
If you do lose your phone, it's handy to have a note of its IMEI number. And you can do this on all phones. Type in *#06# and your phone's unique serial number will be displayed on screen. Make a note of it.
It's very easy to confirm that the phone belongs to you. So you tell us the IMEI and we'll tell you if we've got your phone.
Unclaimed items become the property of TfL and are either auctioned, donated to charity, recycled or disposed of responsibly, whilst proceeds from those auctions and unclaimed currency are put towards the running of the costs of the Lost Property Office.
Never give up hope. The reason I got involved with lost property is that one day I lost my own laptop. And I went through the process thinking, you know what, I'll give up. And I went to a lost property office and it was there. And I thought, wow. So when I had a chance to come through TFL's lost property office, I thought, you know what? What a great feeling I had getting stuff back, and, you know, what a great idea to be able to continue that for the travelling public. So, you know, 5 years on, I'm still seeing the smiles on the faces of the people we can get the property back to.
Located at 200 Baker Street, right by one of the entrances to the Tube station, is TfL's lost property office. It's been here since 1933, and currently receives over 1,500 items every day that are lost on TfL services, including the Tube, Overground, buses, and taxis.
Right, so this is the heart of the lost property office, and every day we're getting 30 or 40 completely full sacks of lost property. It's just relentless, never ending. So every day we're getting well over 1,200 items of property coming through. That's every single day.
In the 1950s, the most common item lost were pairs of gloves. But over time, things have moved on a little. You might think mobile phones would be the most popular loss, but actually, it's only second on the list. Items are sorted and catalogued onto a database. Someone with a smart sense of humour called the system Sherlock. And in instances where the owner can be identified from the property straight away, contact is made to let them know. Government legislation dating back to the 1930s states that lost property must be stored for a period of time, in this case, 3 months. Now, you might not think that people are so honest, maybe even less so in London, but actually a quarter of items found on the transport network are successfully returned to their owner.
Sometimes the reaction we get when people come in and pick up their property is just disbelief. Firstly, a lot of people don't actually inquire about their lost property because they simply think, look, I've lost something valuable. It's never going to be handed in. And I think you'll find that the travelling public, Londoners in particular, are much more honest than you'd think they are.
Even more surprisingly, for items with a higher value, such as wallets, purses and phones, the rate is as high as 40%.
So every day we're getting over 150 mobile phones. It's really interesting. Whenever there's a new model is released, it takes probably no more than about 48 hours before we get our first phone in.
If you do lose your phone, it's handy to have a note of its IMEI number. And you can do this on all phones. Type in *#06# and your phone's unique serial number will be displayed on screen. Make a note of it.
It's very easy to confirm that the phone belongs to you. So you tell us the IMEI and we'll tell you if we've got your phone.
Unclaimed items become the property of TfL and are either auctioned, donated to charity, recycled or disposed of responsibly, whilst proceeds from those auctions and unclaimed currency are put towards the running of the costs of the lost property office.
Never give up hope. The reason I got involved with lost property is that one day I lost my own laptop. And I went through the process thinking, you know what, I'll give up. And I went to a lost property office and it was there. And I thought, wow. So when I had a chance to come through TfL's lost property office, I thought, you know what? What a great feeling I had getting stuff back. And, you know, what a great idea to be able to continue that for the travelling public. So, you know, 5 years on, I'm still seeing the smiles on the faces of the people we can get the property back to.
Fin de la prueba.